Welcome to the Clinical Research Coach Podcast. I'm your host, Leanne Wolke. In this podcast, we bridge conversations between industry, thought leaders, and patients. Utilizing a unique perspective, integrating years of coaching with Tony Robbins, coupled with scientific and industry experience, we have vulnerable and real conversations with the goal of impacting the industry in meaningful ways. Today on the podcast, we have Craig Serra. Craig is the head of commercial solutions and partnerships at Flatiron Health. He's been named one of Pharmaceutical Executive's Emerging Pharma Leaders, as well as Pharma Voice's 100 Most Inspiring People. Craig's got over 20 years of industry experience. He's worked at both large pharma companies like Novartis and Pfizer, as well as CROs. You're going to love this session with Craig. Enjoy. Welcome to the podcast, Craig. It is a pleasure and honor to have you here today. Let's start out. Tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get into this industry? I know you've got a diverse background. You've definitely had a lot of fantastic positions, but tell us, what's your journey been like?
Well, thanks for that, Leanne. So the journey, Craig, the formative years, going back to when I was a teenager, I basically worked as soon as it was legally allowed in New Jersey. And so I worked in a pharmacy. It was bought and then bought by another chain. So, and this is like at the advent, I mean, before the internet. And so I was interested in the science of it, interested in customer service, interested in the tech part of it. And I basically grew up in a pharmacy, and pharmacists were saying be a doctor, doctors were saying be a pharmacist. And I took none of their advice and got into clinical research by accident, like I think a lot of people in the industry. First role at Shearing Plough when it existed, got lucky and was able to move to Pfizer a few months later to work with some awesome people. And 20 years later, hard to say that, I've had a tremendous amount of leaders that I've looked up to and that have given me some opportunities. And it's been a fun ride, but it's kind of all started out with having a curiosity towards a few different things. And so I've always kind of meddled and played in those different areas.
And that's, you touch on something that I think is so important, is that sense of curiosity. And at the heart of what we do in this industry, it really is curiosity. It's like, well, gosh, let's answer what's an interesting question to ask.
That's right.
And being bold enough to ask that question and not know the answer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I pull on this experience a lot because it was very impactful. But the parents that have, their 4-year-old coming from the ER where they have a script for pink amoxicillin at 5 of close or 5 minutes to close in the pharmacy, like that customer service orientation to asking questions of why is the pharmacist going back and forth for the same medication and they seem to be walking an awful lot, and why don't we just put everything that's commonly used right behind them so it makes it easier for them, like asking those questions and just being curious about that. Is this sort of in my DNA? I've just always been like that. I'm sure my parents would say I was a very curious kid. But basically, asking those questions requires not just that curiosity, but it requires some tenacity on following through and getting answers that you might not like, and having, some form of thick skin to get answers you might not like, and the tenacity to kind of bring solutions forward if the need arises. So that's what I tend to orient towards.
So this is interesting because this isn't what I intended to ask, but this usually is how this happens as we get on like a tangent. But I'm curious because, I started in the industry in 1995, the days of 3-part NCR forms, and nobody really knew what a clinical trial was. And then it was just, you had to do whatever had to be done to get the trials done. So it was traveling 70 to 90% of the time on a different airplane every Monday, going to different locations. What would you say? Because I think we've got a lot of people that want to get into the industry nowadays, I hear, and they don't know how to do it. And there's people in the industry, and I think our culture has changed, again, my personal bias, as, you know, as a culture, that people are afraid to be wrong. So how do you nurture people as they come up in the field that, hey, yeah, it's, you got to ask the questions and it's okay to be wrong?
Yeah, it's maybe it's a nuance of this, but I actually think it's afraid to offend. So no one wants to offend someone else, but I don't see the afraid to be wrong kind of thing. But I guess in people that are either independent of age, but like clinical research naive, I think the way to get into it is first, just educate very briefly. I mean, I'm talking Wikipedia, right? Like, educate yourself about what clinical research is. I remember back in grad school, I remember asking a presentation if people knew how a drug got from a lab to their medicine cabinet. And it was just, no one had any idea. And I think one person was the closest to say, like, there's some testing done on it, but they were imagining lab testing, right? Like preclinical stuff, like basic science. And so this clinical research world is a incredibly unknown world. The pandemic shone a light on what that is, this broad, you know, bunch of activity happens to get something to market. But now we kind of suffer from a little less of an education issue and much more of a trust issue for many reasons. But I would say for someone to get into it, educate yourself a bit, understand, you know, what pharma companies fundamentally do, and, you know, at a 30,000 foot view, what the process is like from preclinical to clinical to commercial. Understand what CROs do, and what, you know, tech companies do. You don't need to understand the minutiae and the parsing out of, you know, an EDC vendor does this and an ECOA vendor does this. And I like that level of detail comes with time. But just to get into it, I think educating yourself, connecting with people in the industry. I've been, like I said, I've been fortunate to have tremendous leaders that have given me, you know, chances at, you know, trying to succeed and putting me in the best position of success. And so I try and pay it forward a bit. If someone reaches out to me and says, you know, I have an interest in what, you know, Pfizer is doing with the pandemic, and, you know, I'm good with data, I'm good with this, we'll talk through it. And they're, you know, welcome to reach out to me on something like LinkedIn. And if they have a true, real want and orientation towards that, they'll sort of carry that forward if I put them in touch with a few people to kind of further talk through it. And I've seen several times people end up in roles that they're thriving in and love it. And from a standpoint of process, it started with them being curious enough to even educate themselves and reach out in the first place. So the world right now is so connected that that's not the issue. The issue, frankly, is going to come down to if someone has an interest, carrying that forward and being tenacious with, you know, maybe to your point, to getting some rejections along the way. And I've had more than my share. They don't feel good, but they build character, as my parents, I'm sure, would say.
Okay, so I have to ask, what's been your biggest rejection?
My biggest rejection? That's a good question. I don't know if I have a biggest rejection. It's sort of a death by a thousand cuts kind of thing. Because I'm a very kind of excitable guy. Like if I think of an idea, if I want to do something, like I kind of just act on it. There's a lot of people that certainly would take a lot of pause. They would think about it, kind of ruminate a bit, you know, engineer a path forward. I'm sort of like, I'll take the next step and I'll take the step after. And then, oh, I took the wrong step, I got to go backwards. That's just the way that I'm oriented. So I think it's far less about some big grand fail than just on like a daily or weekly basis, just being like, ooh, whoopsie. But
there's that willingness. Yeah, the willingness to get back up. There's, I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's kind of fun. There's this thing called rejection therapy that some guy put together. And it's these crazy things that you're supposed to go ask someone out in the world to practice getting rejected. Like, it might be ask for a discount somewhere that doesn't give a discount. Maybe you go to Starbucks to get a coffee and say like, hey, it's Wednesday. Can I get the Wednesday discount of 20%? Because, you know, or you...
I know what you're talking about. I think I saw the interview with Gary Vee, and basically it's almost like in my undergrads in psychology, I'm remembering this, like it's akin to exposure therapy. You know, if you're afraid of snakes, like 10 out of 10 afraid of snakes, like the therapy to get at least acclimated to not lose your mind is basically just to be exposed to that over and over. And that's, that's, I think, after a few attempts at trying, after a few, just a few times, I think rejection isn't no one's being mean to anyone. It's just that you're not the right fit, or they don't hear back on a message. Like if there's going to be a level of sensitivity to that being framed up as rejection, that's tough. That's tough. Cause again, everyone's connected to everyone, over communicating everywhere. And so that's going to happen way more often than not. So I would hope that there's some level of awareness that you just have to be, you know, again, a bit tenacious and a little bit of thick skin to take step after step.
Right. Right. Now you talked about, you know, the industry is so connected nowadays. The world is so connected. How do we integrate as our study teams get bigger in clinical trials in this whole field? How do we integrate and how do we better optimize our teams across different companies, countries, functions?
It's a great question. I don't know if, I mean, there's probably textbooks written on this, right? In my view, it's being clear on simple things, roles and responsibilities, being clear on accountabilities, being clear on where the incentives are, kind of having our eyes open to, you know, oh, if we want to implement some solution over here that takes away revenue from this company over here, and we're all working, quote unquote, together, there's going to be an obvious friction. Now, maybe not between the individual peoples, but the people, but the entities that they are working for, they're you know, is going to be an inherent friction there. And I think just acknowledging that is a big step in the right direction. And again, being clear on what each person is doing, I can't tell you the amount of clarity that brings to people, because it's frankly not a matter of there's not enough solutions out there. It's that there's so many permutations and combinations nowadays for tech and process and orgs and all that kind of stuff that it's just mind-blowingly complex. And so to try and simplify things, just knowing what we each do and we're not going to do is really amazingly helpful. And even just from some recent time in the past 3 or 4 years, bridging a whole bunch of different geographies, probably more so than I had ever done before, understanding their points of view, understanding their reality. Referencing the pandemic again, I think we saw a lot more into people and to their world than we ever have before. It went from 10 people on a study team that were, you know, Pfizer, IQVIA, Medidata, right? Being represented to Bob, Susie, Bill, and that they had kids in school and that they had a sick uncle. And so understanding that that is reality and that fundamentally it comes down to the fact that we're all human and part of this, you know, this human race, like there's an amazing clarity that comes from that and an amazing empathy that comes from seeing those different points of view. And I was fortunate to experiencing through a very bad time in our history.
I think that it's been interesting. During that time, I work with Tony Robbins as a trainer in addition to my role in this world. And we went from having, you know, events in stadiums where everyone went to the stadium to meeting people in their homes on Zoom. And so we could have an event with 20,000 people and you're looking at 50,000 people online in 196 countries coming together for 4 days. And as you talked about the empathy and the humanity, was a way to connect that I don't think anybody ever realized. And out of that, I think we've seen this this emergence of new technologies and new ways of doing business in our pharmaceutical drug development world with decentralized clinical trials, moving into people's homes and wearables and technology. So what is the next iteration of this look like? I think it's an exciting time. And I think in 5 years, it's not going to look anything like we've known.
Yeah, it's, I agree on the, certainly on the broad strokes. I tend to be quite bullish on that world. I think far less than some, but I think the distinction comes from the fact that a lot of the things that we have utilized for the DCT world, we've had for quite some time, actually. We've had eCOA for a long time. We've had telemedicine in healthcare for quite a long time. In clinical research, not so much. Maybe that was a bit novel. But all these sort of other things we've used in sort of fits and bursts. And I think the novel part where there was most excitement was bringing that all together and saying that we could run a trial more or less, and I hate this phrase, end to end with, you know, a single or a small number of solutions that were sort of replacing the typical incumbent process and tech stack. And where I land is, I think, you know, as we pull back from the pandemic, as we see macro, you know, financial downward pressures, I do see that we still can be having a bunch of hybridization, as we might call it, because there are so many players out there and so many choices. But also just basically trying to take the complex and make it less complex. And I think that is paired up with the financial piece is going to result in some consolidation. I think we're going to see some M&A activity. And I think that the overall, well, how many studies are we running that are decentralized or that have the look and feel of a DCT, I do think is going to have a nice growth rate. I think it's going to end up being by less players. And I think that is reflective of that, we'll just call it like the 2.0 version of the DCT world. Because from a buying perspective, of which I spent the majority of my career, it's really tough. You want to buy everything, right? Because everything looks so good and you can see the way things fit into a certain puzzle, but there are just a lot of players out there. I'm currently, you know, the head of commercial at an awesome, very, very unique place at Flatiron and loving every second of it. But there are a lot of players out there. So I think it comes down to differentiating yourself, and inevitably in a half a decade, I think we're going to see fewer players, but I think the overall growth rate is going to be up.
You know, if we look at all the growth that's occurred, the data suggests in any business that about 4% of businesses make it to that 10-year mark. So yes, consolidation and mergers, acquisitions plays into that, you know, because we are going to see that there are certain things about running a business that some of these newer players just may not have. And, you know, that's where we can leverage their strengths and then take them into the fold and give them some of that backbone and structure. Talk to me a little bit. I know that you've been in a trial. Will you tell me a bit about your experience as a patient?
Yeah. So, was in the Pfizer 2-3 pivotal trial. And the mentality now is far different than it was several years ago. Several years, like if we could just transport back a couple of years, I mean, the race to get to something that now is even commoditized, right? The fact that I can just go to the CVS a mile down the road now and just walk in and get a vaccine. Whereas a few years ago, we're talking about signing up for just screening in a clinical trial for something that, you know, we think based on, you know, the earlier phase data was going to be pretty efficacious and certainly safe. There was such demand there. So I was excited from a individual perspective, not even clinical research being in the industry for a long time perspective, but just the fact that, wow, there's this thing that potentially could protect me and family and other people. Like, I was so stoked about it. But the I ended up pre-screening and then passing through screening and ended up going to a site in one of the only in New Jersey that was actually a former Pfizer colleague was running it. And it was a great experience in terms of the care that they gave, in terms of administering the actual protocol. Certainly from, you know, an ops perspective, it was pretty similar to the way that it was, you know, 5 years prior. I was at Pfizer previously. The experience as a patient in terms of like eCOA and filling out diaries and, you know, getting like a whatever reimbursement for travel and stuff like that was pretty much seamless. There was no real kind of issue with that kind of in the first part of the study. The next part, first part meaning the first few months, sort of the next part of the study, and this is where it gets a little tricky. So I'll choose my words wisely. But the amount of, let's say, blood draws that were needed, a lot for a human being, or relatively high. Okay, we'll say the amount of travel back and forth to the site versus could we have done this over the phone? Could I have gone to my local CVS and gotten a blood pressure reading there, or just I have a BP monitor at home? Could I use that? Didn't see much of that. There's a caveat to that though, Leanne, which is they spun up an amazing protocol with a ton of infrastructure in ridiculous time, not sustainable time, but achievable time. And so I look at that, and that is just the way I view it, is it's almost like a belly aching when I think about the overall conduct of the trial. That's just me being having to pick something that wasn't quite as good as I thought it could be.
We always look at how can we make it even better. So for you, as a patient, right? Experiencing that, and imagine, you know, you've got a family, you've got work, and if we're asking someone to go to the site so many times, is there a way that we can simplify that process? Not that there's anything wrong with it. How do we make it even better? I think is kind of the mindset. And that was, you know, I think what happened with some of these things that had been thought about for years were all implemented to get the vaccines approved. Yeah. And, you know, so now it's like, okay, so we implemented all of those great ideas we had and it worked. And then it's just, okay, how do we take it to the next level?
Yeah. And I mean, there's a particular pride just relative to this approval of not even the volunteering with the other 46 or 8,000 volunteers, and I did get placebo, by the way. But the infrastructure at Pfizer, which along with, you know, a bunch of other people, had essentially helped build up and then was deployed years before, that ended up being a lot of the, you know, data capture, you know, risk-based monitoring, data analysis type stuff, to be involved in that, you know, 5 years earlier, and have a leadership role in that, felt, you know, incredible. And they scaled it up to an awesome scale. And we're all here with commoditized vaccines because of that. And these are people that, like, to a person, need to be like applauded and commended. I could go on forever about the perception of our industry versus the reality of who's working in it. It couldn't be more opposite. But I won't. So I'll stop there.
I think that, you know, what you bring up is a good point. And I can't tell you how many times I clarified perceptions during that whole pandemic period. You know, and people would say, oh, I'm not going to be a guinea pig. I'm like, you're not a guinea pig. You know, let me explain the process. So yeah. It does happen. Now, you mentioned that you got placebo in the study. Yeah. How was that communicated to you?
So just part of my background is I'm a pharmacologist, so I do have some orientation towards towards science and what's kind of supposed to happen. So I didn't have an injection site reaction. You know, you were hearing everyone getting headaches and kind of almost immediate pyrexia or high fever. And so I just was like, okay, I kind of communicated to myself that like, okay, I got placebo. When they actually did communicate it, my memory's a little hazy on this. I don't remember. It had to have been after unblinding and after the results, the top line results were reported out. But I remember hearing then that I had it. And there was some question over, okay, did the people with placebo get actual, you know, vaccine for being volunteers? And I think there was some discussion over for a you know, relatively short period of time. And Pfizer did basically give the placebo patients the opportunity to get the vaccine. So that was great. I think Moderna did the same thing. It became more and more common as we got further along the pandemic, but it was communicated from the site. I believe there's either a letter or an email or was an actual call with the PI, but it was done in the way that it needed to be done and should have been done. And so it was confirmation that earlier suspicions. But let me tell you, from a site perspective, we're talking about a different person that knows what they're giving, right? And then you have unblinded personnel, and you have someone physically in a different room than the blinded personnel. You have the person administering the shot that did not know either way. It looked, they were indistinguishable. So like when we're talking control, we're talking control here. This isn't like people are throwing, you know, needles at one another and they're saying, oh, listen, you got the real stuff or you didn't get it. Like none of that happened. It was as controlled as you possibly could imagine.
My curiosity is around a lot of times that we've heard patients say that they were in a trial and they never heard what happened. So I love that you were communicated with and you were able to have that sense of closure and completion. That's one of the things that I've heard. As far as an industry, what we can do better to make sure that we are completing that experience for a patient, or if a patient screen fails, to let them know why they weren't included so that they have an understanding, or even when the drug does become available, letting them know. And that's just a simple database issue, right? So tell me, I know we talked about the issue with sites and research physicians being available.
Yeah.
How do we address that issue?
If we'd like to open up a staffing agency tomorrow, we could. I think there's enough brain pan out there, and there's enough really qualified individuals out there to fill the gap in terms of any sort of we can't find workers kind of messaging and that kind of stuff. But when I think of a site, I think of the most overly burdened people in our clinical research world. If we put aside patients for a second, the orientation towards, and I keep using the word orientation, but the orientation towards thinking about what a site goes through, I think our industry needs to do a whole lot more, including visiting these sites and walking in their shoes for a few hours or a few days and shadowing them and seeing the fact that PIs are almost exclusively also seeing patients in the non-clinical research setting. So they're very, very busy physicians. There's huge administrative burden just from a healthcare perspective. The clinical research coordinators are sometimes splitting time between seeing patients and doing clinical research tasks. But more often than not, when they're doing these clinical research activities, there's so much, and it ranges from pre-screening to screening to chart review to actual data entry, which is an unbelievable burden on them. And Flatiron Health does have a solution for that, by the way. But the idea is there's such burden on these sites. And so I think it's a combination of increasing the workforce that can do the work at those sites. So if there's any shortage of, hey, we've been trying to fill 5 coordinators spots for the last 6 months and we can't, we should be able to fix that by finding the people that want to be there and just doing a way better job of connecting the two. And then the other way is, well, we have candidates that would go, but they have no interest in being burdened like that. And that's where companies like Flatiron and others can think of what the sites are going through, mm-hmm. think of the biggest high value pain points, and essentially develop solutions to that, whether it's a workflow or a technology or a service with, you know, process consult, whatever it might be. I think that there's an ability to have it be a much more attractive place to work. But as you can tell, I again, typically think of the people that are kind of carrying through a sponsor's activities, to some degree CROs, but essentially sites and obviously patients.
Yeah, I agree 100% with you. You know, the sites are kind of the unsung hero in all of this, because we talk about patient centricity. The patients are going to get taken care of by the people at the site. So we have to create raving fans of the sites, the patients, of course, but the sites really, you know, so that they do want to continue in trials.
Yeah. And just one quick note, I mean, the oft quoted stat of something like a 95%, 96% of healthcare providers have no, they have no relationship whatsoever to clinical research. Mm-hmm. I would love to be able to capture or enable the physicians that do have an interest and be able to enable them to be a research site. I do think I've become a bit more bearish on the fact that that 95%, it's not like it's half want to be in research and half don't. It's more like 9 out of 10 just have no interest in research. And so the idea of like, let's push to convert them to a research site, I don't know if that has much sustainability, because a lot of them are like, ah, I'll give it a shot. And they participate in a trial or two and they go, you know what? It ain't worth the headache. And so I do think we need to make it, we need to take the headache away.
I love that. Just like the aspirin for the PIs, right, that want to be the research site. I want to be respectful of your time, and I appreciate your insights so much. Tell me if you could, what is the one thing that makes the difference?
What is the one thing that makes the difference? Empathy. I would go with empathy. And I'm as guilty as anyone else of forgetting that. But just really knowing that we're all coming at things from our own shared human perspective, but potentially very different individual perspectives, that I think that just having empathy and just understanding what others are going through, it's a foundational kind of thing, right? It's you can't grow flowers in the desert. So empathy would be making that desert into like a very fertile soil, and you get the analogy. But I think it's building from that empathetic kind of mindset and viewpoint.
Great insight. There is a book by Keith Ferrazzi called The New Way of Work, which talks about that. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but fantastic, fantastic consultant, works with a lot of great people, and talks about this new way of work and having some of these conversations that previously were never brought into this space. So
yeah.
I thank you so much, Craig, for your time, for your insights. How can people get in touch with you?
Sure. They're welcome to send me a note on LinkedIn. They can send a craig.sarah@gmail, craig.sarah@flatiron. Feel free to reach out. And yeah, thank you for your time, man. This is a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Clinical Research Coach. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love it if you'd subscribe and leave a rating and a review. I truly hope that you got something out of this episode that can help us all work towards our goal of making a meaningful difference in the lives of others.